The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is your home for NPR news and programming since 1985, 91.3 KUAF. And this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, January 10th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. In a moment on Ozarks, the 91st session of the Arkansas General Assembly is now in session. After one day, there are no answers to what tax reforms will take effect or just how medical marijuana will be handled. But lawmakers say they're ready to take on those big issues. And Roby Brock, with our content partner Talk Business and Politics, will talk with political writer John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette about the upcoming political season. First, Ozark Regional Transit is working today to figure out how to provide service after an early morning fire destroyed 20 buses at the ORT home in Springdale. Jeff Hatley, the spokesman for ORT, says the staff met this morning just after 8 to try to take a triage approach to providing some kind of service.
When you have 30 buses, and of those, probably 24 are on the road any given day, and then you get 20 taken out of the fleet, yeah, there's no contingency plan for that.
Hatley says the director of Ozark Regional Transit, Joel Gardner, has been contacting other agencies in an effort to find buses that can be used as quickly as possible. A post this morning shared with the Southwest Transit Association asked for the loan of vehicles until ORT can be back on its feet. Jeff Hatley says there have been some early responses.
There's one transit system that's got some vans that carry 12 passengers, which is smaller than our typical bus, but some of our lesser used routes, we might be able to incorporate those smaller vans. We've got some transit systems fairly close by that are on their winter reduced route service, so they may be able to provide some.
Hatley says two buses were not at the Springdale facility last night, but were being serviced at a nearby garage and will be able to be used. He says other buses spared had been retired for cost-effectiveness reasons, but might be put back to use.
We've talked about what it would take to get at least one of those up and running. They're perfectly safe. They're perfectly fine. They're just they require a lot of preventive maintenance, so they weren't necessarily cost-effective, but they're certainly roadworthy. Or can be roadworthy very soon.
Even with a patchwork plan, most routes and services will be disrupted at least immediately following this morning's fire. Hatley says almost everybody served by ORT will be affected.
If they're using anything other than our commuter express route that we just initiated last week, or Route 65, typically going to the Georgia's chicken plants, if they're using anything other than those, they are going to be effective definitely today, probably the next couple of days at least. We are going to do our best to get more vehicles in, and we will be making constant press releases and social media updates to let the public know when and where they can catch a fixed route once we get those reestablished. In the meantime, we do every one of our minivans survived the fire, so we are still running that model, and we will obviously give preferential requests to medical type things rather than just trips to the grocery store. So those types of trips may be delayed so that we can give the priority to people who need it for dialysis and chemotherapy and doctor's appointments and things like that.
Jeff Hatley is the spokesman for Ozark Regional Transit. This morning, a fire destroyed 20 of the buses, a majority of the ORT fleet. He says people with questions about service for the next few days and perhaps weeks can check the ORT social media outlets or call 756-5901. The Arkansas General Assembly is officially convened for its 91st regular session. Lawmakers began the session yesterday and will, over the next few months at least, turn attention to competing income tax plans and implementing the state's voter-approved medical marijuana. Speaker Jeremy Gilliam was unanimously elected to serve a second term in the leadership role. The Republican from Judsonia says in a new era of expanded term limits, the pressure to perform is greater.
For the first time in over two decades, we have an opportunity to maximize the potential of our institutional knowledge. It is our responsibility to apply that knowledge to overcome the challenges that we face. Our branch of government can once again grow roots of stability. We have been given an opportunity to lead, and we cannot afford to squander it.
Speaker Gilliam also referenced Abraham Lincoln's team of rivals and ideologically diverse cabinet as an important model for civility. Three Democrats who switched parties after the November election received committee chairmanships. The speaker says there is no quid pro quo for their shifts in party affiliation, but Democratic Minority Leader Michael John Gray says he thinks otherwise.
It was not unexpected. A couple of them for the last year, we knew that they probably were angling for a chairman position. There will be a lot said about that, but really it didn't catch us off guard. So maybe the sting was lessened because we were prepared for it a little bit.
But the Democrat from Augusta does place his confidence in Speaker Gilliam to lead with a collaborative spirit. Republicans hold supermajorities in both chambers of the legislature. Jonathan Dismang of Beebe was approved, by the way, for another term as Senate president. Before the gavel was used to call the session into order yesterday, Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics sat down with John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, to talk about the upcoming session, but also to talk a bit about some legislative-related news that broke last week. The guilty plea entered by outgoing Republican State Representative Micah Neal of Springdale to receiving kickbacks related to general improvement funds.
This is a pretty big deal. We knew that this story was out there for a while, but this is the chapter we've kind of been waiting to see close and more to come.
It's got a couple of elements, but one is there has been nervousness and sort of percolating worry in the legislature for, I think, maybe up to 2 years, a year mm-hmm. and a half, that the federal federal prosecutors, federal authorities were looking into state legislators with their general improvement money, which is the money they take for themselves and route it through planning and economic development districts for their personal projects, that they were investigating kickbacks, that they were actually, in delivering this state money, which they shouldn't have been doing in the first place, there were reports that some were actually getting some of it back personally. And then that was compounded by these reports that there were other issues too having to do with behavioral health
right.
companies in this, and it's sort of just a smelliness to a lot of the state's Medicaid contracting and maybe some legislative involvement or lobbyist involvement. So what this was lame duck Representative Mike O'Neill, who did not run again, acknowledged that he had taken money back in concert with an unnamed senator.
Right.
With some involvement by an unnamed lobbyist, both of whom were described in his in the information about him in a way that, you know who they are, but I'm not going to say.
Right, right. Innocent until proven guilty.
Right. Yeah. You know, and so it's up to the federal government to name the names. So the issue is, how big is this? What is this the start of? And a couple of years ago, people were saying there was a vast public corruption issue arising in Arkansas. That, I don't know.
That's, we'll see if it comes.
But this was, just to back up, the General Improvement Fund is money, that's the state surplus money.
Right.
They're always,
typically goes to one-time projects.
It does, and it used to go just to the governor or to state agencies for state building or capital improvement projects. With my shameful support at one point back in the 80s or early 90s, Nick Wilson and Bob Johnson and some others took some of the money from Governor Huckabee, and so the legislators could have their own projects. Then they were told by courts they couldn't do that, so they started the charade of running it through these planning and development districts, which would then release the money pursuant to the directives of the legislators. Governor Hutchinson says he thinks we will not have any general improvement money in this budget, and we shouldn't. The whole concept, the idea of legislators having their own personal pots of money for what I call their play pretties, simply should not happen.
Congress goes back in this past week, off to a little bit of a sloppy start, would you say, for the Republicans?
Off to an unbelievable start. Yeah, I assume you're referring to on the day before they went into session, the Republican conference met and voted by what was a secret ballot. We can't find out how they voted because it was a secret conference. to abolish the independent agency office set up to investigate ethics complaints against members of Congress, to abolish it and put it under the aegis of the House Ethics Committee.
This was a burning campaign issue for the last year, right?
Yeah.
Right, not.
We're going to feed the swamp, I think is what they said. We're going to make the swamp worse. Or we're going to regulate the swamp ourselves. And the outcry was, they said, the reasoning for it, ostensibly, is that this independent agency had gotten out of control and wasn't extending due process, and there were unfair, anonymous complaints made on a partisan basis, and it needed to be reined in. Well, the people didn't go for that.
Right.
When the first thing you do, when you're taken over fully, you got the president and the Congress completely. When the first thing you do is meet in private and rein in the group that is authorized to investigate right. Your ethical performance, somebody should have noticed, and I think Paul Ryan did.
Yep.
This is probably
not going to work out.
They had
good.
To take it back the next day.
Let's talk about it. I'm going to give you some choices here because okay. There's been so much to talk about at the national level. You've got now the wall is maybe not going to be paid for by Mexico, although Donald Trump says it's going to be paid for them by later.
Right.
With Obamacare, we're going to repeal and maybe not replace it, maybe delay it. You've got the whole Russian situation.
Which one you want me to talk about?
You pick one, the one that you want to talk about the most.
What was the first one?
The first one was the wall.
Oh, well, during the campaign, I will just tell you this. I went out and did a piece for your magazine finding Trump supporters in Arkansas and early and saying, why? Why are you for this guy? And do you really believe he's going to build a wall? And most of these folks said, and make Mexico pay for it, and most of them said, he's at least got to try. But when he says he's going to make Mexico pay for it, that probably means that he's going to extract something from them in some sort of trade penalty or some sort of indirect method of
not
payment.
Send me a check.
Right, right. Rather than Mexico saying, okay, build it and we will cover the charges, that they were pretty well resigned that he was talking about something else. So we'll see about that. But I do. That was out there before the election, the idea that the Mexican payment would be a reimbursement,
yeah.
An indirect after-the-fact reimbursement. Obamacare. Here's my Sunday call. Trump said repeal and replace. Hillary Clinton said fix, keep it and fix it. I think what the Republicans are going to do is repeal it to great fanfare, to great conservative celebration, repeal it, but delay the repeal for 2 years so that nobody notices anything different, and during those 2 years, construct something to replace it that will be more a fix than a replacement.
I think you're right about that.
I think there will be no individual mandate. They just don't like that, and I think they're going to change Medicaid to block grants, but I think these changes, the money for expanded Medicaid, coverage for pre-existing conditions, coverage under your parents' plans to 26, et cetera. I think they're going to put healthy increments of that back. But what they want in the interim is the big headline when they repeal it.
That's
when they
right.
repeal what
That's
they're
right.
going to basically put back.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. He talked to Roby Brock with our content partner, Talk Business and Politics. You can find updates on the legislature and other Arkansas news every weekday afternoon at talkbusiness.net. And still ahead on today's Ozarks at Large, words from men on death row form a new staged reading that will be presented Friday night in Fayetteville.
And the warden just sat there the whole time. He was at the end of the hallway just watching us with the gate open and just kind of sitting there. And I went up to him and said, thank you very much for this opportunity. And he said something like, you bet. Of course, I see another side of these men that you don't get to see.
A preview of the work On the Row ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
In 2008, the new president-elect told a crowd in Chicago that there would be setbacks ahead.
But America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there.
8 years later, the president returns to Chicago for his farewell speech. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for live special coverage tonight on NPR News and watch a live fact check at npr.org.
President Obama's farewell address can be heard live tonight beginning at 8 on 91.3 KUAF. And this programming reminder, NPR and KUAF will provide live coverage of the inauguration of Donald Trump as the nation's 45th president on Friday, January 20th. The live coverage will preempt that day's edition of Ozarks at Large and will delay broadcast of that day's edition of Science Friday until 7 that night. Live coverage of the presidential inauguration can be heard Friday, January 20th on KUAF, and President Obama's farewell address tonight, live beginning at 8. This is Ozarks at Large. Mikasius Camp Hornick was among a core group of indigenous organizers who worked to block planned construction of a shale oil pipeline near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota last year. The member of the Ponca tribe, who lives in Oklahoma, met with Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently when he made a trip to Fayetteville.
In June 2014, Dallas-based Energy Transfer Partners announced plans to develop a $3.8 billion, 1,200-mile-long pipeline to transport 600,000 barrels of fracked shale crude oil per day from the Bakken fields of North Dakota to a refinery in Patoka, Illinois, in order to reduce hazardous overland rail shipments. When tribal members learned the pipeline route would cross North Dakota Sioux Treaty territory, as well as the Missouri River, a drinking water supply for the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, they established the Sacred Stone Camp near the town of Cannonball last April to stop the project. Ponca Nation member Mikasi Camp Hornick arrived at Sacred Stone Camp in August.
There was a encampment of about 35 to 50 people that was there. It was a prayer camp.
Mikasi Camp Hornick is state director for Bold Oklahoma, part of a five-state coalition of Native and non-Native activists promoting responsible clean energy development. In early June, construction company Dakota Access had secured the necessary permits, including U.S. Army Corps of Engineers flowage easements, to build Energy Transfer Partners pipeline across four states. A month later, the Standing Rock tribe filed an injunction to block it, which failed. Pipeline construction commenced in early August. By mid-September, Mikasi Camp Hornick says indigenous people from across the U.S. and Canada were converging on Standing Rock to join the protest, along with thousands more non-Native allies.
At that time, the Tribal Council, Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council, made a motion to open up some other lands that was on the Army Corps land north of the Cannonball River. And that became at first known as the Overflow Camp and the overflow from the Sacred Stone, and then grew into the Osheti Salkowi Camp.
350 tribal nations from across the United States and Canada came to Standing Rock, engaging in daily prayer ceremonies and rituals. Drugs, alcohol, and weapons were strictly prohibited at the gathering.
The outpouring of support from people around the world, donations came in, and the love and support of like-minded people coming together to protect Mother Earth, people just started sending donations and sending money, and people started coming and volunteering their time and sacrificing their lives to be there.
By then, Mikasi Camp Hornick had been placed in charge of coordinating the Osheti Salkowi camp, as well as certain pipeline construction blockades. In October, a federal court of appeals began to hear arguments against the Standing Rock pipeline route based on evidence indicating the presence of historic ceremonial and burial sites. President Barack Obama announced alternative routes would be considered, but a final decision would take weeks or months. In the meantime, construction continued.
The water protectors and land defenders went in and tried to stop the bulldozers from destroying these sites. The Dakota Access Pipeline private security used attack dogs, pit bulls, and German shepherds on our people that day. It was a really hard thing to witness. It was a hard thing to be a part of. It crushed our people's morale to see the burial grounds being destroyed, to see these sacred sites being destroyed, to see our people being attacked.
In late October, tribal leaders facilitated a prayer walk, deciding to press on and occupy a nearby pipeline right-of-way. Mikasi Camp Hornick, along with his mother, noted international Ponca tribal activist Casey Camp Hornick, were among 141 people arrested.
it was similar to a scene out of the 1800s with the cavalry coming in and raiding, you know, a traditional Native American camp. They came in with automatic weapons, flipping teepee doors open, arresting people. My mother was arrested that day. She was standing on the road praying in prayer and in song and prayer. I was arrested in a prayer circle with 49 other people that were sitting in a prayer circle, locked in arms. There was a lot of things that took place that day. It was a really scary thing to be in the middle of. The militarized police that came in with the Humvees and armored vehicles, automatic weapons, rubber bullets, tasers, mace, tear gas. And it was just like being in a war zone.
After arrest, they were taken to an underground parking garage and placed in cages, which Mekasi Kampornik describes as dog kennels. He was charged with public nuisance and engaging in a riot, as well as reckless endangerment by fire and explosion. That second charge has since been dropped. On November 21st, Standing Rock made international headlines after authorities attempted to dislocate activists from a pipeline construction access bridge using water cannons and rubber bullets in frigid temperatures. By early December, thousands of sympathetic U.S. veterans had deployed to Cannonball, North Dakota, triggering an emergency eviction notice by the governor of North Dakota, which was later rescinded. Then suddenly, on December 4th, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied Energy Transfer Partners easement to drill under the Missouri River, requesting further environmental review and exploration of route alternatives.
We did have close to 10,000 people at the camp that day, and we were engaged in a hands-around-the-camp prayer. So these tens of thousands of people were standing in a circle, holding hands and praying at the exact time that the Army Corps released their statement to deny access. So it was not only a joyous occasion, but it was just a powerful statement, I think, by the Creator telling us that we did right and that our efforts weren't unseen or forsaken.
Mekasi Kampornik is back home now in Oklahoma, focused on the Diamond Pipeline, a newly permitted $900 million, 440-mile-long interstate project extending across Arkansas to Memphis, Tennessee. From America's oil hub in Cushing, Oklahoma, a region plagued in recent years by earthquakes linked to oil and gas production.
We're the pipeline capital of the world, and we are also the earthquake capital of the world. And when you put these two things together, it spells devastation.
Last year, the U.S. Geological Survey documented more than 1,000 earthquakes, measuring at least 3 magnitude, up from 2 earthquakes in 2008. Mekasi Kampornik is currently building alliances with Arkansas activists concerned about oil and gas development, as well as tribal activists in Oklahoma. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
We have links associated with the story, as well as an extended conversation, at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. KUAF is supported in part by Golan and Sharon CPAs, providing tax and accounting services to businesses and individuals. Located at 64 West Colt Square in Fayetteville. 521-0451 for more information. And 91.3 KUAF is also supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include American College of Radiology certified imaging departments, infusion centers, pharmacy, clinical trials, and more. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
I'm Robin Young. As President Obama gets ready to deliver his farewell address, we'll look at what past presidents said. Dwight Eisenhower issued a warning.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Next time, here and now.
From 1 to 3 today, 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large. It's been more than 4 years since the first Prison Story Project was presented, first to inmates at a women's correction center, then to the public in Fayetteville. The Prison Story Project puts writers and inmates together to produce stories, poems, songs, and other forms of creative written work. The first sessions were conducted with women prisoners. Then later, a men's prison was included. Now, death row inmates. Friday night, a new work titled On the Row will be presented at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. Members for the project traveled to the Varner unit to work with men on death row. The premiere of the work was performed at Varner for those inmates. Last week, four of the principals involved with On the Row came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Kathy McGregor, the project director, David Jolliffe, the creative writing assistant and an actor in the piece, Troy Schremer, theater director and an actor, and Matt Henriksen, creative writing director. Matt says the experience of working with the men in the Varner unit was different than previous Prison Story projects.
They've had an awful lot of time to process their experiences before they committed their crimes, and also living with the crimes they committed, and also living just completely cut off from society, cut off from the rest of the prison population. They have themselves, they have each other, they have the guards, they have very little outside contact. What happened there that's different, I think, with the men and the women who serve, you know, 2 to 10 year sentences that we normally work with, there's this outburst of pain and then a sort of resolution and hope. And with these guys, they'd already gone through all that 1,000 times over, and there was a lot of wisdom and peace, understanding of self. They were surprised by themselves. They didn't expect to be surprised the way that we told them they would be, but they did go through the process in exploring their writing and taking chances. And I think they saw that they were able to express the things that they hoped to say and hoped to have heard by the outside community, maybe in a way that was more dramatic than they'd hoped for, and certainly representative of maybe not the depth of their experience, but a lot more of the surface than they had dreamed would have happened.
What were the logistics? How did it work?
Well, so our access to these men was unprecedented. I don't know how Kathy managed this, but we were able to not see the men one-on-one, but as a group. And instead of seeing them through the glass of the visitation cells, we were allowed to go into the actual, in between the cages, they call them, where they're loaded in for visitation. So we could shake their hands, we could lean on the bars and have a chat, we could hand them pens and paper and swap books, and they'd give us their artwork and stuff like that. And they couldn't all see all of us at once. They're in individual cages. They can't have contact with each other. And so we would walk up and down the row, and we'd read a poem, and we'd have a conversation about it, and then they would write, and they'd share, and we'd have these poetry readings where they'd each read from their own spot.
Could they hear each other?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's a narrow hall?
Yeah, it's a very narrow hallway.
With bars, and the men are behind the bars.
Mm-hmm. You can touch both sides of the bars, yeah, on either side if you put your arms out. And there were, I would say, 14 cells.
I think there's 16. There are 8 on each side. And, you know, state law says that no 2 death row inmates are ever permitted to be in the same room at the same time with each other. So they would bring them in one at a time. They would come in shackled at the neck and at the waist and at the feet. And they would have a guard on each side, and they'd bring them in and then place them in their individual cells. So we were working generally with 8 guys, is that right?
8 or 9.
So but they'd be 4 on one side and then 4 on the other, or 4 and 5. So they would see each other when they came in. They'd greet each other, they'd say hello, and then they could hear each other when they were reading their poetry back to each other. But really, it was kind of like, as Troy mentioned when we performed down there, it's kind of like performing in a subway car. You know, you just have to walk up and down the aisle while you're teaching, as well as when you're performing.
Tell me about the performance.
Well, when we were invited back to bring their work to them, and they knew that would be the culminating event, we had different ideas of how we were going to perform this, and we originally were told, well, we'll videotape it, and then we'll broadcast it closed-circuit television to the entire prison. Any prisoners who want to watch it in their cells can watch it. And we're like, no, this needs to be live. We need to perform it for the writers. And so we were allowed, the actors, we brought in four other actors, and we all basically lined up in a row in this narrow hallway, and we had a writer on our right and a writer on our left who was behind the bars and was watching us, and some were sitting and some were standing there right next to me, and we just began. And so there was no real staging with it, and there's a song in the piece, and it's rather than it all the pieces just being one person after another, some of the pieces are shared among the actors. And so you'd get that kind of movement. But mostly, we were reading the words of these men right to their face. And the two men that I was basically reading, their voices, I could turn and look at one, and he was, 2 feet away from me, and just smiling and beaming, radiating light and joy. And I could turn to the other, and he was, very quiet and sitting there and taking it all in. And that was kind of the experience of all of them, that some of the men who wrote these pieces were just bursting, and others were very contemplative and really watching us, but you could have heard a pin drop.
Could you gauge reaction? Were they pleased that you were there, or would this bring up things that...
I think that's a really important part of the story, is that they pushed back against us more than any group we've ever worked with. They were curious. They did the work, and they continually expressed their misgivings and their disbelief that we would be able to tap into what we said we would. And Kathy and David and I going down there, we didn't know if it was going to work. I remember, I think it was my second trip, our third trip down. It was like, we better get some work today, or we're not going to have a performance. Mm-hmm. It's not happening. And that was the day they kind of just exploded. and we're reading piece after piece, and we're trying not to like break down and cry because it was just beautiful. I mean, sad stuff, but also joyful stuff. And then we slowly started to have more of a connection with them through the work. I think there was a personal connection that happened first, but they started to see that they were writing in ways that they hadn't written before, and that they were building a sort of collective voice. And it wasn't until the performance where they really, really saw and heard themselves projected back at them in a way that was something that lifted them up and was something that they wanted us to be able to carry to the outside for them.
Did you get a sense that maybe they saw this as an opportunity to have part of them exist beyond what is the inevitable conclusion?
Yes, I do. And we, at the end of the outside performances, we had folks write comment cards, their responses to them, rather than they write to me and say, well, how did it go? So we just sent, I think, over almost 200 comment cards. I copied them all and sent them to each of them as a way to just demonstrate that, yes, you were carried out. I had one inmate write me back and say, I noticed that the postage for this was $6.80. If you had sent me that money instead, I could have bought 2 packages of ramen noodles. So there was also that, and I really want to speak to that for a minute. There was this sense of disbelief that from these men on the row that we would be allowed to come in there and do what we did. And that was always, I mean, people would say, I'm pinch myself. I cannot believe that you... That you have been allowed to come in here. So as a result of that, and because they've been so isolated, there were other ways in which they wanted to use us as we were there. So that was a hard part of the work, was to stay focused and to try to keep them on focused on what we were doing there, that we weren't there to take other people's agendas out or or to bring in pen pals or to send them money for food. We were there to, and the prison wouldn't allow us to do that anyway. That was a prerequisite to us coming, was that we, that the inmates who wanted to participate would participate fully as volunteers and not because they would receive anything in return.
Obviously, whenever you're taking somebody's word, someone's life experience, there's a responsibility there. But if we assume that these men were not wrongly convicted, not just anything gets you to death row.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking generally murder and often multiple or horrible. Did you ever, would you think about the crimes? Did you know the crimes each person committed? And
I'll admit, I made the mistake the very first night we got back from death row. I got on Google and I just said, okay, I want to find out why are these guys on death row? And I shouldn't have done it. I just shouldn't have done it because they did commit, if they were rightfully convicted, they committed heinous crimes. But what I discovered in working with these guys, like the mean number of years that our inmates had been on death row was 21 years. I mean, these guys have been on death row for an average 2 decades. Those crimes were committed at a time of their life in various sort of other times of dysfunction, family, substance, all sorts of things. And, you know, to look at the 8 people we work with right now, I would not believe that these are the same people that I learned about when I Googled their work.
I intentionally didn't. I kept the crimes completely out of my mind. Plugged my ears if anybody started talking and didn't look anything up. I wanted to meet them. It was hard to go in there. It was before I'd met them. I knew when I went in, I had to really focus on look them in the eye, shake their hands, and ask them to tell their stories like we do every prisoner we meet. And they disarmed me with their friendliness and their openness and their honesty and also their awareness. Like in an interaction with these guys, they could tell where you're at. They can tell your mood. They can tell, you know, how honest and you're being. You can tell if you're paying attention. After we finished the creative writing portion, so I had gone back after that for the performance and saw them after I read their crimes, but David had invited Kathy and I to do an ancillary event, and we were going to speak in public, and the creative writing portion of the class had been done, so I went down the list one afternoon, and I read all their crimes, and it changed my life. It changed my life to work with these guys and meet them and to see how much peace they found after about 20 years. A piece that probably surpasses what a lot of us have out here in the streets. And then seeing what some of these guys who by that point I considered friends had done shook me real hard, shook my foundations, makes it really hard for me to put any kind of judgment on a person and what they did. Really kind of set the tone for me thinking maybe we need to reevaluate how we judge people.
Matt Hendrickson is the creative writing director for the Prison Story Project's Death Row program called On the Row. Matt and others from the project will present the work Friday night at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. And in a moment, we'll hear more from our conversation, including an example of some of the material. That's just ahead on today's edition of Ozarks at Large. KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, showing the art of American dance now through January 16th. The first major traveling exhibition to showcase works related to the many styles of dance. It features artists such as John Singer Sargent, Mary Cassatt, and other icons of American art. CrystalBridges.org for more information. KUAF is supported by the City of Eureka Springs, trademarked the Wedding Capital of the South, featuring a variety of wedding venues, caterers, and reception halls for the intimate event to the opulent. Information regarding wedding packages, tips, parties, and luncheons available at eurekasprings.org/weddings.
On the next Fresh Air, why growing numbers of Americans are saying goodbye to monthly fees and overdraft charges and abandoning traditional banks. Lisa Servon got jobs as a teller in a check cashing agency and a payday lending store to understand why so many working people turn to banking alternatives. Her new book is The Unbanking of America. Join us.
Fresh Air, twice each weekday on 91.3 KUAF at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. This is Ozarks at Large. We'll continue now with our conversation with four people involved with the latest work from the Prison Story Project. Friday night, the group will present On the Row at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. The program was created with material collected during sessions with death row inmates at the Varner Unit in Lincoln County, Arkansas. Last week, the project's director, Kathy McGregor, the creative writing director, Matt Hendrickson, and David Jolliffe, creative writing assistant for the project and an actor in On the Row, came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio to talk about the performance that's already been presented at the prison. Also with us during the conversation was the project's theater director, Troy Schremer, who read an excerpt from the stage reading.
This is something that we're going to add because this was a piece of writing that actually came later. Being pen pals was not really a part of our agenda, but writing is still coming forth, and they're sending it to our post office box, and so we're still getting things. And I also found that the majority of the writing was more about their own journeys, their own feelings about the day-to-day and where they're at right now. There was very little talk about, I'm on death row and this is what it's like, or I did this bad thing. Some of the gritty details that when you think, oh, death row, this is what we're going to hear. And then this piece came back from someone, and it actually speaks just a little bit to being on death row and facing that. And he calls it the 11th hour. The 11th hour. That's what they say my appeal is. I was at the death house, a few short steps from the death chamber where I was to be executed on a very specific date. 2 days before, I had my last visitation with family members. Tears filled all eyes as we hugged and said our last goodbyes. My soul drenched in sorrow. It was all my fault that this day had to happen. Sleepless, as thoughts of familiar faces and places I had been or remembered. The arriving day. A chaplain or two come for a few words in prayer. Attorneys come, pleading to give them a chance at review. The hours are passing like a second hand. A few promises are made, a paper signed. I heard my name. Here you're close to where it's almost time. And then the phone of an attorney rings. A burst of joy. And I heard, you got a stay of execution. You got a stay of execution. I feel no sense of relief. Grief and remorse grip my heart like a vice. Extra time has only added to the pain, not only that of others, but even to myself. It's no use trying to make sense of it all.
It really shows you that these are men in a situation that we cannot begin to fathom.
Right.
I mean, the four of you have been there, so you have something of a better idea, but I just can't.
I think that something that was a common theme, and it is in our reading that we are presenting to the public of On the Row, is this idea that they are treated like animals. That's how they voice it. We are treated like animals. And this is a chance for their voice to be heard and for them to be treated like human beings. And the fact that we spent time with them, the fact that we listened to them, the fact that we went over and over their writing so that we knew some of their writing better than they knew some of their writing and could quote it back to them, treated them with dignity and respect, and does not negate the heinous acts that have been committed, the crimes that they have committed against society, against individuals. but they're still human beings. And to me, the little bit of joy that we were able to bring them that day in October when we went into the death row and performed for them, and they were somber and serious and joyful and exuberant and overwhelmingly grateful, it was such an important moment in my life. And as Matt, you were speaking to this idea of how we judge people, really taking that into account, and really, what is that? What am I doing when I judge other people's actions across the gambit? And I'm not advocating one way or the other with how, when someone commits a certain crime, what their punishment should be. And the law is the law, and these men are where they are at. But they are human beings. And when they're treated like human beings, I am joyful. And when they are not treated like human beings, I am sorrowful. And so, to me, this is an opportunity to give these men their humanity. And when it gets shared with others, and then they know that someone's hearing their words, that feeds their soul. And all the time that they are spending in isolation, and all the time that they have to just sit there and sit there and sit there.
I've read accounts, you know, from the famous concerts that Johnny Cash would do, and how wardens perhaps didn't want it to happen at the first time, but they would say morale actually improved because of this. What, as much as you can give us, were there any negotiations that went on here that you had to? Don't reveal anything you can't reveal, but.
Well, how we got there. Because I had this little idea that I wanted to go to death row, where stories are the most kept in the dark, when we did the men's performances in Pine Bluff, I invited the warden from Varner, which is where death row is, to come to hear those staged readings, because it's hard to talk about the staged readings. It's much easier if you just see the staged readings. And experienced them. And he came. He came to the first one. And then when we went back to Pine Bluff, to the men's prison there, I invited him again. And he came again because he liked it so much. And that's when we then approached and said, could we come do this on death row? And the warden really paved a way for us to do that.
And the warden just sat there the whole time. He was at the end of the hallway just watching us with the gate open and just kind of sitting there. And I went up to him and said, thank you very much for this opportunity. And he said something like, you bet. Of course, I see another side of these men that you don't get to see. Mm. And it was sort of like just a little reminder that they were happy to see us. There was a back and forth, an exchange that was positive and humane. And the guards and the warden have a different relationship with them. And So it was sobering, but again, I was just so thankful that mm-hmm. he had given us access, given us clearance, and given these men this opportunity.
Would you go back if the opportunity?
Absolutely,
in a minute.
Not only would I go back. You know, I think all of us continue to be in communication with. Maybe not all of the inmates, but, you know, the inmates, it's interesting, you make friends. You make friends of those particular people, and there's one inmate in particular who wanted to have an intro to lit class. He said, David, could I have an intro to lit class? So I actually, at the end of the first semester, I put together a little introduction to literature class for this guy involving some students from the University of Arkansas. We mailed down some responses to poetry. He looked at them and mailed his own back to us. So I continue to write to him, and I just sent him a story the other day. I say, here, read a story. So no, I'd go back in an instant.
They held impromptu poetry readings after the last few times we were there waiting to be taken out, and it's just spread. They're like, everybody on the row wants to write with you mm-hmm. guys now. So it sort of blew up a little bit at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I just heard that they now have 43 pieces that they're of writing that they would like to send for us to create the next stage reading.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
is there a place online where people can find out more?
Yes, prisonstoryproject.com.
All right. Matthew, Kathy, David, Troy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathy McGregor is the project director for Prison Story Project. Matt Hendrickson is the creative writing director for the Death Row Project. David Jolliffe, creative writing assistant for the project and an actor in the piece. And Troy Schrimmer is the theater director and an actor. On the Row will be presented Friday night at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville at 7:30, with a panel discussion to follow. Music will be provided by Kelly Mulholland. The doors will open at 7, with some food and beverages available. You can learn more at nwaprisonstories.com or at the NWA Prison Story Project Facebook page. This is Ozarks at Large. Walton Art Center presents A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. Tonight through January 15th, this Broadway musical comedy tells the story of Monty, who sets out to eliminate the 8 relatives who will inherit the family fortune before him. All the while, Monty juggles his mistress, his fiance, and threat of jail. WaltonArtCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, in 1996, the Arkansas Department of Education counted 6,000 students enrolled in homeschooling situations. 10 years later, the number had more than doubled.
Last year, our final numbers towards the end of the year was a little over 19,000.
The growing number of homeschooled children in Arkansas on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
As President Obama makes his farewell address, we are looking back at some of his earliest appearances on NPR in the early 1990s.
I'm very interested in figuring out ways to foster dialogue between the private sector and the public sector, between blacks and whites.
I'm Kelly McEvers, remembering Barack Obama from the NPR archives. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From 3 to 6 this afternoon on KUAF. And this is a service of the Walter J. Lemke Department of Journalism at the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Springtown. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget President Obama's farewell address carried live at 8 tonight from NPR on KUAF. We'll end this edition of Ozarks at Large with music from Lost John, recorded inside the Carver Center for Public Radio. The song is Going Home. Lost John and Willie Carlisle will be live at George's Majestic Lounge Friday night, beginning at 10. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your Tuesday.
They ask me where I'm going, and they ask me where I'll stay. I got the time and a reason, it ain't good enough to say. I'm going home. Going home today. I'm going home. How long I can't say. So today I'm leaving Austin, man, that big city's great. I'm gonna have to tell all my friends that I'll see them on down the way, 'cause that big wheel's a-turning a little faster every day. I got the time and